We tend to forget what's important to us or what's in our own true interest. And also when we have very strong emotions, it's like we go into another thought world entirely. When we're in a state of anger and a state of fear, reality seems very different from when we're in a much calmer state. And so what we need is this ability to remember what our calmer thoughts are as to what's really important in life, what our real values are. The fact that we tend to forget like this is nothing new. I noticed when I first came back to the States after being in Thailand all those years that in Thailand, people come to Buddhism largely for protection. Protection in all kinds of ways. Anything from an amulet through the practice of meditation is regarded as a way of protecting yourself from the dangers that are all around you, the dangers that are inside you. Whereas I come back to the West, and the emphasis seemed to be on interconnectedness and what a wonderful thing it is that we're all interconnected, and how we should all trust the fact that we're interconnected. And of course, events keep telling us that no, you can't trust the interconnectedness. It's, as the Buddha himself said, the fact that things are so dependent on conditions that are so complex, this is one of the reasons why we suffer. To think of interconnectedness as being something good and safe is actually heedlessness. And so we have to have a sense that there are dangers out there, but as we get a sense of what really is dangerous, and we can learn how to keep that in mind so that when we get into these strange thought worlds that are influenced by fear or influenced by anger, we don't lose our priorities. In the same way as when you're in a dream, alertness helps you realize, hey, wait a minute, I'm dreaming. Mindfulness reminds you, okay, there's another world out there in which the events of the dream really don't matter. But the real world out there is much more important. You want to keep that in mind. And then ardency is, you've got to get out of the dream. And so these three qualities help you as you get into unskillful mind states so you can remember what your true values are. There's a story, there's a novel by Kurt Vonnegut, Sirens of Titan. I don't know if anyone here has read that. Yes, okay. One of my favorite novels. There's a character in the novel who's been kidnapped, taken to Mars. It's a science fiction story. He's taken to Mars where they're planning an interplanetary war. And he's part of this army that they're going to be training. And he's beginning to notice there's something fishy about the organization. It's not really trustworthy. And the organization realizes the soldier knows too much. And so they erase his memory. Now, they've erased the memories of other people as well, and they found out that if you erase the memory entirely, the person becomes totally useless. So you have to leave something of the memory. And so this person has had his memory erased many times because he keeps figuring things out. And so he's realized there's a spot in his memory where he stores things that he can keep. And one of them is he's going to write a letter to himself and he's going to remember where the letter is. And then he goes back after he's had his memory erased, finds the letter and reminds himself, okay, these are the people you got to watch out for. These are the people you can trust. And the question is, if the Buddha were writing that letter, what would he put in the letter? What would he say as to what's important to remember? Who's dangerous? What are the dangers and where are the ways you can get out of those dangers? First, his perspective on what needs to be protected. He says your most valuable possessions are your virtue and your right view. Right view being the belief that your actions really do matter. They will have long-term consequences. So you have to always make sure that your actions are skillful. And then, of course, virtue follows through that. If you avoid anything that would be harmful. And the Buddha says, if you have to make a choice between losing your virtue and your right view on one hand, or on the other hand, losing your health, losing wealth, even losing some of your relatives, he says, you hold on to your virtue, you hold on to your right view. Because those things can have really long-term bad consequences, where you're going to get your wealth back someday, you're going to get your health, you're going to get your, even though your relatives, in the principle of rebirth, they come back too.
Sorry, sir, what was the title of the novel?
The Sirens of Titan by Kurt Vonnegut. That's one of the most beautiful passages, or nicest imagined worlds I know of, is his world of Mercury. Mercury is a crystal, a honeycomb crystal, and it's part of it is facing the sun on one side and the dark outer space on the other side. So there's this strong tension between the cold and the heat. And so there's a lot of vibrations to the crystal, and there are these little animals that called the harmoniums who feed off the vibrations. And they're shaped like little kites with little cups on suction cups on the ends of their corners. And they go around the crystal and they find places where the vibrations are really nice. And because they don't have to feed on each other, It's a very happy world. And they send out two messages, each of them. And one message is, here I am, here I am, here I am. And the other one is, so glad you are, so glad you are, so glad you are. That's an aside. But when you think about that and you think about the world we live in, yes, we do live in a dangerous world. People feed off each other. And we also feed off the wrong things. And as the Buddha said, the fact that we have to feed, that's why we suffer. So the Buddhist perspective on what needs to be protected, as I said, is virtue and your right view. As for the dangers come in three levels. The first level is outside dangers. And from the Buddhist perspective, it's not so much what other people can do to other people do to you, it's what they can get you to do. Now, given that your actions are your most important possessions, if they can get you to do something unskillful, they've really harmed you. So this is one of the reasons why you need right view, is to remind yourself, okay, I can't let myself be swayed by other people's opinions, especially when they are trying to get me to do something that's unskillful. Then there are the inside dangers, and those are your own unskillful actions and your own unskillful views. And then there are the ultimate dangers, as the dangers of aging, illness, and death. And these even come from skillful actions. You know, from the Buddhist principle, you can live a skillful life, be reborn in a good situation. But even that is going to be subject to aging, illness, and death. So there are three levels of danger, just the fact that other people can get you to do unskillful things, your own unskillful actions. But then there's just action in general, ordinary skillful actions can lead eventually to more aging, more illness, more death. And the way out of that, the Buddha said, is to develop a type of karma that leads you away from the karma that would cause you to come back. And in order to give you instructions on how to do that, you take the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the Buddha, the person who found the Dharma itself, which is the teaching of the truth that he found, and then the Sangha, this exists on two levels. One is the monastics that the Buddha, starting with the Buddha, Buddha's training, ordained and followed his example. And then those who, whether they're monastic or not, have actually gained a taste of awakening themselves. And these are our three refuges. Of course, they're not going to come down and help take us away from the danger. What they do is they act as examples to be on one level. As this is how true happiness is found. The Buddha found true happiness through his own efforts. The members of the Sangha found happiness through their own efforts following the Buddha's teachings. And so they provide us with an example of how we can find true happiness and how we can find safety from these various dangers. We need to remember these so as not to be swayed by the bad examples all around us, including false teachings about happiness and the way there. Then there's another level of the Buddha and Dharma and the Sangha, which is our internal practice. In other words, we take their qualities and we try to develop them within ourselves. We learn that the Buddha had wisdom, compassion, purity. We try to develop those qualities within us. The Dharma teaches us to develop mindfulness, concentration, discernment. We try to develop those within us. That protects us from the inner dangers of our own unskillful actions. And finally, there's the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha as the ultimate goal. The Buddha is kind of a stand-in for the goal of nirvana, which is a true happiness that's not subject to any kind of conditions. It's not subject to any kind of change. That's the ultimate goal, and that's also the ultimate refuge. When you can find that dimension inside you, it's something that can be touched at the mind. That's when you found the goal, that where you're totally free from any danger at all. So let's go through some of these examples. The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. I'd like to take the Dharma first because as the Buddha said, he respected the Dharma as something higher than him. And as I said earlier, the Buddha teaches right mindfulness as the Dharma that we want to follow in order to find refuge. We have to understand that the right mindfulness is not something separate from the practice of concentration. In fact, the description of right mindfulness is instructions on how to get the mind into concentration. Pulls you out of your ordinary world and creates a skillful inner world where there's a sense of well-being that comes from within. You have your own independent source of food or well-being, so it means you're going to be less likely to be overcome by external fears and pressures. Now, important part of getting the mind into concentration is learning how to step back from your thoughts. This is another way in which mindfulness practice helps protect you from getting into unskillful mind states, helps pull you out of those mind states. The Buddha himself said that he first got started on the right path when he realized that he should look at his thoughts not so much as to whether they're true or false, or whether he likes them or doesn't like them. The question is, where do they come from? Where do they lead? What kind of mind state would give rise to that kind of thinking? Is it a mind state that you can trust? And then secondly, if you were to follow that kind of thinking, what would it induce you to do? And he began to realize there were two types of thoughts, i.e. skillful and unskillful, when they were viewed in this way. The unskillful ones, ones that were based on sensuality, based on ill will, or based on harmfulness. The ones that were safe were the ones that were based on renunciation. In other words, you want to get past your obsession with thinking about sensual pleasures. You want to get past your ill will by developing goodwill, and past your harmfulness by developing compassion. And as he said, as he divided his thoughts into these two types, if there were thoughts that were on the unskillful side, and just as to clear up at one point, when he talks about sensuality, he doesn't mean sensual pleasures, he means our fascination with thinking about, planning for sensual pleasures. He said that's what actually ties the mind down and can lead you to do all kinds of unskillful things. I'll give you an example. Maybe after tonight's talk you want a pizza. Okay, the pizza takes what? 15 minutes to eat? Okay. But you can think about it for the rest of the hour, right? And you think about which kind of toppings do you want, and which kind of pizzeria do you want to go to. And you know, we really get attached to this ability to fantasize about our sensual pleasures. And the fact that we're more attached to them than to the actual pleasures themselves. I'll give you an example. You've been thinking about how you want a pepperoni pizza down at Pizza Hut. You go down to Pizza Hut, Pizza Hut is closed. You say, no big deal, there are other pizza places out there, and you can start fantasizing about another kind of pizza you want someplace else. But if someone were to tell you, you cannot think about pizza for the rest of the hour, you would probably rebel. So it's sensuality. Those kinds of thoughts can get us into trouble. And the Buddha said, if he saw his thoughts were going into sensuality, ill will, or harmfulness, he would have to hold them in check. And he gave the example of being a cowherd. He said, during the rainy season, the cowherd has to keep the cows out of the rice, because otherwise there's going to be trouble. Back in the old days, in fact, that's what the major causes of court cases in rural Asia were, cows getting into the rice. So you've got to keep the cows out of the rice, and you do everything you can to keep them under control. And then he said, however, if his thoughts were the types that were skillful, in other words, thoughts of renunciation here doesn't mean that you're just going to give up on pleasure, it means you're going to find a pleasure that's not sensual. In other words, the pleasures that come from getting the mind in concentration, the pleasures that come from developing skillful thoughts. They're thoughts of renunciation, goodwill, compassion. He said, okay, I could let those thoughts go, wander around as much as they like. In the same way that a cowherd during the dry season doesn't have to worry about the cows getting in the rice. So all he has to do is sit under a tree and rest and think about the cows are over there someplace. I'll get them in the evening, but right now I can rest. So the beginning of mindfulness is closely related to what the Buddha called right resolve. In other words, you resolve to say, I'm going to hold unskillful thinking in check and allow skillful thinking to go where it wants. Although he said, ultimately, even skillful thinking gets tiresome, and that's why you want to bring the mind into concentration. So when we're being mindful of our thoughts, it doesn't mean simply noticing that there is a thought. You notice, okay, is this skillful? Is this not? Where does it come from? What kind of motivation is leading there, giving rise to this thinking? And if I follow the thought, where is it going to lead me? What kind of actions is it going to lead to? And from there, then you remember, okay, skillful thoughts have to be developed. Unskillful thoughts should be abandoned. This is the role of the mindfulness there. So you're alert to what's going on. You look to this as a causal process, and you're mindful to realize, okay, what needs to be developed and what needs to be put aside. You find this also in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the main sutta on mindfulness, or one of the main suttas. It talks about the hindrances, in other words, factors that get in the way of concentration, like sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, and uncertainty. These are things that you have to learn how to first recognize. This is what mindfulness does. You recognize, okay, sensual desires come into my mind. This is unskillful. This is a hindrance. First, you have to recognize it. And then you remember what to do with it. Is this something to be developed or something to be dropped? Now, for most of us, recognition is a major problem. Ill will comes in, and we can really think, that person really is really awful, and I can really think of all kinds of good reasons why I should be upset at this person. Sensual desire comes in. It's not the first thought to say, hey, this is a hindrance. It's usually, hey, this is something fun. This is entertaining. Let's go for it. So mindfulness is there to remind you, okay, these are hindrances. And then it reminds you, okay, this is what you've learned about hindrances in the past. This is what you've learned about how to get rid of them. Similarly with the factors for awakening, mindfulness, analysis of qualities, in other words, being able to analyze your mind as to what's going on. Persistence, rapture, calm, equanimity, concentration. These are things to be developed. So you recognize them. Say, okay, this is something I've got to encourage in the mind and try to make it grow. So mindfulness doesn't just sit there and watch things coming and going. You try to give rise to skillful things, get rid of unskillful things. And this way you protect the mind. You get the mind in a position where you are ardent. I mean, first you're mindful to remember, recognize these things, alert to notice what's going on, and then ardent to do the actual duty that needs to be done. And this is how you begin to train the mind so it does become more and more reliable. It does become its own mainstay, something that it can depend on. So these are some of the lessons of the Dharma as an example to be taken, or an example to be followed. As for the Buddha, there are three main qualities that are associated with the Buddha: his discernment, his purity, and his compassion. We think about his discernment, his realization that, okay, even though he had power, wealth, beauty, all kinds of things that most people desire, he said, this is not good enough. I want something that does not die. And his realization that kind of living your life in a way where you're searching for your happiness, things that age, grow ill, and die, is not a noble life. A noble life is when we look for something that's more permanent, more reliable. He realized that, you know, he had to make a lot of sacrifices to find that. He had to recognize that when he went to study with various teachers, that they didn't teach the way that led there, and he was going to have to find the way himself. There's one instance in his life that I found especially inspiring. After he left the teachers, he practiced austerities for 6 years. And pretty strong austerities. And you would think about what would keep a person going. And he was holding his breath so he'd get, you know, he'd stop breathing. He would feed only a little tiny bit of food. He was afraid of any kind of pleasure whatsoever. Kept this up for 6 years. Now, what keeps you going is usually a pride. In fact, he says he realized after the end of 6 years that nobody else had ever undergone those austerities as far as he had. And yet he was willing to drop that pride. He said, really, this hasn't led to where I want. There must be another way. And so the followers he had developed at that point abandoned him because they thought he was going to a life of luxury. He realized that didn't matter either. He really wanted to find the way that would really work rather than just continuing to try to keep other people inspired by him. So basically, he set his own priorities as to what was really important in life. And this is what we'd look for in terms of his discernment. When he was teaching, again, he set his own priorities. He didn't get caught up in the useless controversies of his day. He focused on how you put an end to suffering. Anything that was not related to that, he said, okay, we're going to put that aside. Focus entirely on this. So when the issues came up about the media they had in those days, he said, okay, is this important? Is it not important? If this is related to the end of suffering, fine, we'll focus on it. If it's not, we put it aside. This was his discernment. His purity was he wasn't swayed by honors or wealth even when he was on the path. And after he had said he wouldn't let himself allow his mind to be overcome either by pleasure or pain, and that he wouldn't teach until he'd attained the goal that he looked for. And after he did become a teacher, he wouldn't accept payment for his teachings. There was one time a Brahmin came and offered him a payment for the teachings he had given. It was some food. And the Buddha said, I cannot accept a payment like that. In fact, now the fact that you've offered that as payment for the teachings, nobody can eat that. He said, throw it away in a pool of water. Threw it in a pool of water, and it sizzled. That was the kind of purity the Buddha had. And the Dharma was not for sale. He offered it freely wherever he went. As for his compassion, you think of all the things he could have done after his awakening, but instead he chose to teach the way to the end of suffering and offered it freely to anybody who was ready to hear what he had to teach. There are lots of examples. He'd walk for days on end to find people. There was a sick monk who nobody else was looking after. He and Ananda went and looked after the sick monk themselves. He taught the Dharma to an outcast. He taught the Dharma to a leper. There were two women who had lost their children. And he found them in the cemetery where they're mourning their children and taught them so they could overcome their grief. Even on the last day of his life, he walked all day, even though he was suffering from dysentery, to find one last person that he was going to teach. He taught that person. And then, because he had dysentery, he was concerned that the person who had given him his last meal would be criticized by everybody else. So he said, go tell that person he made a lot of merit, and tell everybody else that he made a lot of merit. I mean, even as he was dying, he had that kind of compassion to think about the future of the people he'd been living with. So these are some examples of the Buddha in his search for happiness. He was willing to make sacrifices for what he felt for something that would really be of worth, that was really worth all the effort that goes into the search for happiness. That's his discernment. As he followed his way, he was constantly upright in everything that he did. And then once he found the way, he showed compassion in many, many ways to many, many individuals. And as he said, the beginnings of wisdom, compassion, and purity all center on how you go about your search for happiness. He never says that the search for happiness is a bad thing or anything you should be embarrassed about. It's nothing shameful or nothing to be ashamed of. He says, if you do it wisely, it becomes a source for wisdom, compassion, and purity. As he said, the beginnings of wisdom or discernment is the question, what when I do it will lead to my long-term welfare and happiness? Now the wisdom or discernment there is in one, there is such a thing as long-term happiness. It's better than short-term. Well, it sounds obvious. but as there was one translator who translated a verse in the Dhammapada that said, if there's a greater happiness that comes from abandoning a lesser happiness, the wise person will abandon the lesser happiness for the sake of the greater happiness. The British translator who translated that into English wrote in a footnote, he said, this could not possibly be the meaning of this verse. It's just too obvious. And sometimes we need to be reminded of the obvious. So, wisdom lies in saying there is such a thing as long-term. It's not just waves crashing on the shore and going away. There is long-term happiness. Secondly, it's better than short-term. And third, it's going to come from your actions. It's not going to just come floating your way. And so the wisdom is, okay, it's going to be through our actions that we can find long-term happiness. And you want to find somebody that you trust and ask that question of that person. That's the beginning of discernment. As for compassion, there's a story in the canon. The king is in his private room with his favorite queen. And in a tender moment, he turns to her and he says, is there anyone you love more than yourself? You know what he's thinking. Typical king. You might even say typical man. say, yes, Your Majesty, I love you more than I love myself. Well, his queen, Malika, is no fool. She says, no. There's nobody I love more than myself. What about you? Is anybody you love more than yourself? That's the end of that scene. So the king goes down to see the Buddha and reports the conversation. And the Buddha says, you know, she's right. You could go the whole world over and not find anybody that you love more than yourself. In the same way, everybody out there loves themselves just as fiercely as you do. Now, the Buddha's conclusion is not that it's a dog-eat-dog world. It's that because of that, you should never harm anyone or cause anyone any harm. The reasoning being that if your happiness depends on harming somebody else, they're not going to stand for it. They're going to do everything they can to stop it. And secondly, of course, it's not fair. I mean, you want happiness. Everybody else wants happiness. What gives you the right to impose your happiness on someone else is going to prevent their happiness? This is the beginning of compassion. You learn how to think about other people's happiness as you're looking for yours. So again, the Buddha's not saying don't search for happiness. It's be very careful about how you look for your happiness. Look for it in things like generosity, virtue, meditation. These are totally harmless. Okay. And then finally, the principle of purity. There's a passage where the Buddha is teaching his own son, and he's saying, before you act, ask yourself, what is the motivation for my act? What do I intend to accomplish by this act? And if you see that the act is going to cause anybody any harm, either to yourself or to other people, you don't do it. If you don't see any harm, go ahead and do it. While you're doing it, check the results while you're doing the action. And if you see that any unexpected harm comes up, you stop. If you don't see any unexpected harm, continue with the action. After the action is done, you look for the long-term consequences, and if it turns out that you did cause harm, you talk it over with someone you trust on the path so you can gain some lessons on how to avoid that harm next time around. And if you don't see any harm, then he says, take joy in the fact that you are continuing in your training. He said, this is how people purify their actions. It's through being very careful about what you do, looking at the consequences. So wisdom, compassion, and purity, these are the Buddha's qualities. And we develop them through asking these questions, looking for happiness in a true way, in a wise way, in a compassionate way, in a pure way. And that's how we create a basis of something we can rely on within ourselves. As for the Sangha, as I said earlier, there are two meanings of the word. There's the conventional Sangha, which are the monastics, and then there's the noble Sangha, which is anyone who has monastic or non-monastic who's practiced to the point of gaining awakening, at least the first taste of awakening. This is not the Sangha in the modern usage of the term, i.e. everybody who's sitting around you meditating, because you can't really rely on those people. You really don't know, you can't really take them as an example. You can take them as an example as far as they're meditating, but after they leave the room, you have no idea whether the people you can rely on or not. You want somebody who's actually practiced in a way that you can take them as an example. In other words, these are people who've made themselves Dharma by shaping themselves in line with the Buddha's example. In the forest tradition, they talk about two principles that you follow. One is one called practicing the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. In other words, you don't change the Dharma to suit yourself, you change yourself to suit the Dharma, or fit in with the Dharma. And secondly, what they call following the traditions of the Noble Ones. The Noble Ones basically have four traditions. One, the first three have to do with contentment. You're content with food, clothing, shelter you have. You see, if I have enough to practice, I have enough to live in essential basic comfort. I have enough in terms of that, and I should learn to be content with that. Anything. And at the same time, however, you don't exalt yourself over the fact that you are content with little. In other words, I'm more content than the person next. You watch out for that. And then the fourth one is that you learn how to take delight in developing skillful qualities and delight in abandoning unskillful ones. In other words, you have to learn how to talk yourself into wanting to do the path. You don't do this sort of just against the grain or gritting your teeth. Most of us, we enjoy our craving, we enjoy our desires, we enjoy our unskillful habits. And the Buddha said, well, you should learn how to enjoy learning how to say, okay, I got beyond that, I was able to say no to that unskillful habit, and whatever is required to develop skillful qualities, I've learned how to enjoy developing that. When you take your joy in those things, then, as the Buddha says, you're following the traditions of the Noble Ones. And this is the way that following the Buddha, we also develop our discernment, our compassion, and our purity. And so these are some of the ways in which the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha are examples that we can take in terms of how we find happiness in our lives. And we try to take their qualities and develop those qualities within us. That way we become a refuge for ourselves. We have a solid set of values, we have a solid set of a strong sense of our priorities, what really is important in life and what's not important in life, so that we're not so much subject to the waves of public opinion or waves of what's going through the media. So basically, and if the Buddha were writing that letter to that character in the Sirens of Titan, he'd probably say, one, deathless happiness is possible. It is possible to put an end to suffering. It will, however, depend on your having right view and having virtue. So those are qualities that you have to protect. Remember where the dangers lie. The dangers lie in people who would try to get you to break your virtue or develop wrong view. And then remember, okay, there it is possible to develop skills like the Buddha's that will lead you to true happiness. So his letter was basically saying, watch out for the people around you who tell you, that the current danger in the media is the worst thing that can happen to you. The worst thing can happen to you is if somebody can get you to kill, steal, cheat, lie, have illicit sex, take intoxicants. That would get you to believe that your actions are really not important. And this is basically what the media is telling you. What you're doing right now is not important. What somebody else out there is doing someplace else is the important thing for you to know. Whereas the Dharma goes the other way around. It says, the most important thing in your life is what you're doing right now. So be very careful about what you're doing. And it's if you take that principle and follow through with it, then you become your own refuge. So try to keep that in mind, then be alert to when you're not keeping that in mind. And then if you find yourself straying away from that principle, okay, try to be ardent in doing what you know is skillful. And if you're not really sure yet, well, work on developing more sensitivity into your actions so you begin to see that when I do X, it gives good results or doesn't give good results. That way you become a person of compassion to yourself, compassion to other people, purity, wisdom. You become your own refuge. So those are the thoughts I had for tonight. Are there any questions?
Sorry, sir. What was that title again by Kurt?
Kurt Vonnegut. What
was
the title? Sirens of Titan. It turns out the sirens don't do anything at all. Questions, comments? Become Tommy. Kid you. Yes?
Well, I was just thinking about when you were talking about thoughts and actions and just being in a work environment mm-hmm. and having the negative come up, the complaining mind come up. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but you still have to realize there are some times when you have to say, okay, this is wrong, and something has to be done.
Yeah.
And so you have to learn how to figure out, okay, which complaining mind, don't call it one complaining mind. Think of your mind like a committee, and you've got different complaining members, and some complaining members are actually reliable and other ones are not. And learn how to recognize them. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you say, okay, this is a problem at work, and we really need to do something about it, and then the next question is, okay, what would be the most skillful way of implementing that change?
It's interesting, Kurt von Daniken is bipolar illness. His son has schizophrenia. He used to fly in quite a lot. We meet a real famous psychiatrist called Dr. Abram Hoffer here
mm-hmm.
And apparently Kurt von Daniken was willing to make a novel or screenplay or whatever. He would go off his bipolar medication, get quite manic,
mm-hmm.
and do his best work, otherwise he'd have to be unwell for something. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So he'd go off his meds, do his novel, and go back on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there are a lot of authors like that.
Sorry?
There are a lot of authors like that. Yes. Pleasure seeking?
Like that's all I see is, the sensual or the craving for good times.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the idea of pleasure itself is not such a bad thing. The question is what kind of pleasure are you looking for and how are you going to go about it? Now, the Buddha said, there is a pleasure that comes from concentration. Now, the pleasures that come from living in a harmonious group, there's the pleasures from being in nature, there's the pleasures of seclusion. Those are actually okay. In fact, different sensory pleasures, different people are going to find that they will have a different impact on the mind. But he says, our big problem is the sensuality, as just this fascination with thinking about what next sensual pleasure you're going to have. And to solve that, the Buddha says, you've got to get the mind in concentration, find a sense of pleasure there. And then once you have that pleasure, then you can sort of wean yourself off.
So that's arrived at through continuing practice.
Continuing practice, yeah. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, the Buddha never made any sharp distinction between mindfulness and concentration practice. I mean, his description of how you get the mind into right mindfulness, that's his instructions in how to get the mind into concentration. And you know that you're doing it right when there is a sense of well-being, there's a sense of fullness, there's a sense of refreshment. Okay, you're on the right track. And then when you have that as your independent source of pleasure, then you can look at the other things in the world that you're, you know. I mean, this is how society controls you. They say, okay, here's this pleasure here, but watch out, there's this danger over here. So do what we want to, so you can keep this pleasure. And if you realize, okay, I don't need your pleasures, then you're independent. Yes.
Did he say anything at any time about manipulation?
Manipulating whom?
Well, manipulating other people, manipulating mm-hmm. situations.
Mm-hmm. Depends on your intention.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on your intention. If it's for that person's good, and you're sure that it's for that person's good, you can manipulate them. I mean, there's a classic example about his half-brother who had ordained and was beginning to get, all he could think about was the woman he left behind. And the Buddha said, okay, let me show you something. And so he grabs him and takes him up to heaven and shows him the nymphs up in heaven. And and he says, okay, compared to these nymphs, what do you think about the woman you left you behind? He says, compared to them, she's just like a cauterized monkey with her ears and nose cut off. And the Buddha says, okay, I promise you, if you stick as a monk, you can get nymphs next lifetime. And so the brother goes off and he practices. And the other monks find out that he's practicing for the sake of nymphs. And do they give him a hard time, you know? Yeah, you can imagine? And they said, he's a hired man, his wages are nymphs. And he gets so embarrassed that he actually really starts practicing seriously. And then he becomes an arahant. And then he goes to see the Buddha and he says, ah, about those nymphs, I don't need them anymore. And this parallels a story about the Buddha's own doctor. Was not only good at medicines but also good at psyching out his patients. And there was a case where this one guy, he was going to have a brain operation. And he said, you've got two worms in your brain. We've got to get them out. He says, now you have to make a vow that after the operation, you will lie on your back for 3 months and not move. And the guy says, okay, I'll make that vow. So he does the operation, gets the worms out. And then the guy lies on his back. At the end of 1 week, he says, I'm going to die if I can't move. And the doctor said, well, you said you would be able to promise to stay on your back for 3 months. He said, I know I made the promise, but I can't do it. The doctor says, okay, turn over on your right side, but stay there for 3 months. You got to make a promise, just stay there for 3 months. So the guy says, yes. At the end of a week, he says, I can't stay this way anymore. I've got to move. So similar conversations. That gets him to lie over on his right side. And then at the end of the week, the guy says, I can't stand this anymore, and I've got to move. And the doctor says, get up, you're cured. Now, if I told you you'd have to lie there for 3 weeks, you wouldn't have made it. So there is some manipulation, but it's for the person's good. I mean, how else would Asia survive? I mean, Asia's all about manipulation. I had two students, a Korean woman and an American woman, that were going to go to Asia on a tour, and they wanted to get some special arrangements to have extra time off from the tour to go to other things. And the American woman called up the tour agent. At the end of half an hour, she said, I can't go on this anymore. There's no, I can't get what I want. And the Korean woman said, okay, let me talk to the woman. Within 5 minutes, She had sweet-talked her into giving them what they wanted. It's called the Thai smile. We call it the Thai smile. So there is some manipulation, but as long as it's for a good purpose, it's okay. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'd probably say 100% of the children in the world would not be alive.
What would be a good way to measure your progress on the Dhamma path? And one of the things that I felt that, or I, my expectation is that life should get easier.
No.
Mm-mm.
No. The best measure is if things that used to get you upset don't get you upset anymore. No. It doesn't mean that you just accept it. It means okay, I'm not upset by what this person has done, but I can now, I'm thinking clearly so I can deal with it. Old age is when you say I'm too weak to do it, so I have to give in. Wisdom is when you say okay, these people are doing horrible things, but I don't have to get upset, and that puts me in a better position where I can deal more effectively with it. That's the best measure. The things that, you know, when you're practicing concentration, things that used to knock you out of concentration don't knock you out of concentration anymore. That's a good measure. It's equanimity and also patience, endurance. Yeah.
Sorry, just a follow up on that. So I've been trying to keep sila precepts kind of more rigorously than before.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally then we'll run into people who really on the other extreme of what I hold on to as a precept.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you can, you want to be around people who are truthful. Mm-hmm. And if you have business dealings, if you can. But the problem is we live in a world where not everybody's following the precepts. Mm-hmm. And so we have to learn how to protect ourselves. We can't just go on good intentions. We have to be skillful in our intentions. Which means realizing, okay, there are people out there who lie and there are people who are unfair in their business dealings. Protect yourself. But don't let that get you down. I mean, when you follow the precepts, it's like you're taking medicine. And there are other people out there who are not taking their medicine. Now, that shouldn't make you feel, well, I should stop taking my medicine. But, okay, they have a contagious disease, you want to get away as much as you can. But there are still people, you've got to deal with them, you know, whether you know, no matter how much you try to choose your friends and choose your associates. And in the cases like that, protect yourself. And remind yourself, okay, I'm doing this for my own sake, for my own good. And don't let yourself get discouraged.
Just following up to that, because we do a lot of volunteer or serving the community.
Mm.
So it's hard to pick and choose
who you're going to help. Hey, compassion should not depend on whether you like the person. The question should be is, okay, if I help this person, but then they just throw it away, how much more should I help them? But if there's somebody you don't like, you say, okay, even though I don't like you, I'm going to help you. It's the people who, you know, once you've helped them, but they throw it away. They don't, it's like they don't really follow, you give them advice, they don't follow the advice. And that's when the case said, look, the last time I gave you advice, you didn't follow it. How many more times do you think I can give you advice? before I decide that, you know, it's not worth it.
Or if they, we know that they're trying to use our skill
for
to serve them somehow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we want to, we have the skill, we know we can help.
Mm-hmm.
Not helping doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm,
helping just caused the resentment.
Okay, tell yourself, I'm doing this for humanity. I'm doing this to pay off my old karma debts. Jogam Nguyen.
That was the book.
Yeah, balance the books, exactly. Yeah. Oh my gosh, if I taught only the people I like, I don't know. What am I offering? Well, my primary piece of advice is that they don't need to know everything that gets tweeted from the East Coast. And that the media right now are really in a frenzy to try to get worked up to see, okay, there's a lot to be afraid of out there. And if you get into their story, you're going to forget the fact, okay, the most important thing in my life is the decisions I'm making. And then you decide, okay, if you want to focus on doing some social action, focus on an area where you think you can make a difference. And don't let yourself get swayed by you know, all the other many, many, many things that are out there that you can worry about. Say, focus on one thing. Make that your generosity.
Social action is that form of generosity.
Right, yeah. Because you're giving your time, you're giving your energy, you're giving your knowledge. And at the same time, with generosity, it's good to think about what the Buddha had to say about generosity. One is that you give where you feel inspired. There's nobody can tell you that you have to, you know, if you're a good Buddhist, you have to follow this particular social program. It's up to you to decide what you want to help. But at the same time, when you give, you want to make sure that you're not harming yourself, you're not harming others. In other words, you're not breaking the precepts, you're not getting others to break the precepts. You're not putting so much work in that you find that your energy to do good is being depleted. And those are kind of the rules around generosity. Within those rules, whatever you feel is a useful contribution to society, that's fine.
Sir?
Yes?
Can you give us a few tips on the most difficult of all tapasyas or tapas austerities in the celibacy of brahmacharya?
One is, they do the contemplation of the body.
Sorry?
Contemplation of the body. If you say, okay, I'm really interested in so-and-so, ask, okay, which part of her, or which part of him? And then think about taking your own body apart and putting it down on the floor. Okay, which part? And yet when you put it all together, it's really attractive. Okay, which part of your mind is lying to which part of your mind?
Do you have any books here that talk about brahmacharya or celibacy?
You might look online. There's a essay I wrote one time called Under Your Skin.
Sorry?
An essay is called Under Your Skin.
Who's the author?
Me.
Okay. What's your name, sir?
The name you'll find online is Tanisiro Bhikkhu. Yeah. T-H-A-N I-S-S-A-R-O. And that should get you online. You should find me.
Sorry?
That should be enough for you to find me.
What's your last name?
Bhikkhu. B-H-I-K-K-H-U.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Question that I came with
Well, just tell yourself the reason you don't want to get caught up is because you've got some important work to do. Starting with your own behavior and then moving on to what influence you can be on the people around you. So say, okay, I'm not going to let myself get caught up in their stories because I've got my own work that I've got to do. And so sit down with yourself and ask yourself, what is the work I've got to do? What can I add, not only for my own self, but also for other people? There's a series of books by John Mahabua in Thai, it's a series of Dharma talks. A few of them have been translated into English, but the entire set was 80-some talks. He gave it to a woman who was dying of cancer. And the woman went to the monastery, and basically she wanted to meditate, get herself together before she passed away. And John Mahabua said, okay, I can look after your mind, but I can't look after your illness. You need to bring a doctor along with you. And so she searched around, and she found a friend who was a retired doctor, 80 years old, to go along. And they made tapes of every talk that he gave to them. In 3 months, he gave 80-some talks, almost every night. And then they went back home. The woman with cancer died. And then the doctor, who was 80 years old, said, I wonder if I can transcribe those tapes. And so she sat down and she said she got a typewriter, she got everything she needed, and she worked at it. And it was, for her, it was difficult because her eyesight was really bad. But she took encouragement by saying, one teaching from Ajahn Mahabua was that as you get older, you want to see how much more goodness can I squeeze out of this body? Given the limitations it has, what goodness can I still find someplace in my body? And you work on that. Because you're going to have to throw it away at some point anyhow. Squeeze all the goodness out of it. So you know better than I do what your talents are and what your abilities still are. Yes. Did you find yourself getting calm during the guided meditation this evening?
Yes.
Okay. That's recorded?
No, I have it.
You have the recording?
I memorized that and you have it on YouTube.
Okay, well, listen to it again and again and again and again. Find something that you can listen to that would get your mind more and more inclined to want to calm down. Because, it's not all wanting is bad. You know, this Buddha said part of right effort is generating the desire to give rise to what is skillful. And so, again, think of, you've got the committee of different desires in there. Which desires are you going to listen to and which desires are you going to put aside? Because it is necessary to have the desire and it is necessary to say, okay, I want to come back. And from that point on, it's just largely persistent. You stick with it. Don't let yourself get discouraged. And eventually the message will get through.
Sir, what's your website called?
DhammaTalks.org. MMA, as in Dhamma. And then talks, TALKS. .org. Yes.
Mm-hmm. A lot recently, and I'm thinking, I'm not pursuing that, I'm just, I'm experiencing it, mm-hmm. and I'm feeling grateful in the moment, and I'm wondering, is it fair to say, if I continue to do the things that arises from, that I'm actually serving other people by living that life.
Okay, usually the things that will give rise to true happiness inside, they're not selfish.
No.
Yeah. And so it's a good thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It feels really good and clean. And the more I take note of it and really be in the moment with it, the more it happens, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that my interactions with other people, I want to give them that. So that arises on its own.
Well, it arises on its own, but you want to learn how to maintain it. And this is what the meditation is for. Working with the breath gives you a sense of, okay, when it comes, how do I keep that going so it can energize me? And then you think about, okay, the best way to express that for others is, one, hold by the precepts, you're not harming anybody. Two, be generous. And that's basically how you find happiness in a way that's, you know, for your long-term welfare and happiness. You know.
Mm-hmm. Goal.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it's something to pursue.
Right.
I had never thought of it that way. I'm, you know, I guess because I was brought up Catholic.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's, I just wanted to check with you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's okay. Yes. Okay. I mean, look at the Buddha's, you know, the oughts and the shoulds that come from the Judeo-Christian tradition have very little to do with your happiness, right?
Right.
Yeah. Whereas the Buddha's oughts and shoulds come, you know, the Four Noble Truths. You know, you should try to comprehend your suffering. You should try to abandon the cause. You should try to develop the path so you can realize the cessation of suffering. Those are shoulds that are all on your side. And the sort of the Buddhist psychology doesn't have such a huge rift between your super ego and your ego and your id as they do in the West. Yes, it's very good news. Yeah. Yes.
So on that topic, so it's okay sometimes to give yourself a tap on the shoulder.
Of course, yeah.
I'm brought up by Muslims and not too far from Catholics.
Right, right.
And you know, you can't feel happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, as the Buddha told his son, when you realize, okay, I did something well, because otherwise you don't have the encouragement to do it again. Okay, well, thank you.